From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Tomorrow morning, I'll suspend my campaign and return to Washington after speaking at the Clinton Global Initiative. I've spoken to Senator Obama and informed him of my decision, and I've asked him to join me.
With the world economy on the brink and his own presidential hopes in the equation, Republican candidate John McCain on Wednesday announced he would rush to Washington for congressional negotiations on the proposed $700 billion Wall Street bailout. The not-quite-shut-down McCain-Palin campaign described the gesture as an act that put the country above political self-interest. But much of the media were having none of it.
John McCain's decision to suspend his campaign is being described as a Hail Mary by some Democrats.
And I think you see it every time the issue of the economy gets stronger, he goes to a razzle-dazzle play. And I think we saw it again tonight calling for a delay
of the
debate.
The danger is, does anybody see this as non-political, or is this going to be seen as Sarah Palin Part 2?
That was Wolf Blitzer on CNN, Chris Matthews on MSNBC, and Jeff Greenfield on CBS. But, of course, the media aren't only the news media.
You know, this just doesn't smell right, because this is not the way a tested hero behaves. So, somebody's putting something in his Metamucil.
McCain had canceled his Wednesday night appearance on Late Night with David Letterman, explaining he was jumping on a plane to D.C.
We're suspending the campaign.
Yeah.
Are we suspending it because there's an economic crisis or because the poll numbers are sliding?
Then, informed that McCain was at that moment with Katie Couric, Letterman showed a live shot of the senator sitting with the CBS anchor being dusted with makeup in a studio a few Manhattan blocks away. And Letterman just, like, totally went off.
Let's just see what he has to say here. This will be interesting. I wonder if he'll mention me. Hey, John, I got a question. You need a ride to the airport?
For the McCain campaign, this was a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad media week, beginning with a mutiny by reporters who threatened not to acknowledge Governor Sarah Palin's visits with real-life heads of state at the UN unless they were actually permitted to cover the conversations. The campaign responded by letting a single pool reporter witness 29 seconds of baby chat between Palin and Afghan President Hamid Karzai.
Now he's beginning to say daddy, son.
Good. What is his name?
Mirwais. Mirwais, which means the light of the house.
Oh, nice.
He's the only one we have. Yeah. Omar Shah's good.
Sure, the news outlets succumbed to the photo ops, but they also questioned why an executive-experienced vice presidential aspirant, potentially one septuagenarian heartbeat away from the presidency, needs protection from the press. CNN's Anderson Cooper.
It makes them look like they're afraid of her abilities, that she's going to say something. I mean, if she's capable enough to meet with world leaders, not all of whom are going to be as friendly, frankly, as a bunch of reporters are.
Absolutely.
Palin did make herself available for a long-scheduled interview with Couric, for which she had weeks to prepare. It was illuminating.
You've cited Alaska's proximity to Russia as part of your foreign policy experience. What did you mean by that?
That Alaska has a very narrow maritime border between a foreign country, Russia, and on our other side, the land boundary that we have with Canada. It's funny that a comment like that was kind of made to, reporters.
Mocked.
Yeah, mocked, I guess that's the word, yeah.
The McCain-Palin campaign has alleged that the media are out to destroy the GOP ticket. But this week, the press's sharpest attacks came in the form of simply reporting what was said aloud. After a New York Times story about campaign manager Rick Davis's lobbying ties to the collapsing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, McCain senior advisor Steve Schmidt said those lobbying ties were cut years ago and accused the Times of being, quote, 150% in the tank for Barack Obama. The next day, the Times confirmed payments to Davis through last month. As for the coverage of the mostly inaccessible Governor Palin, the charges of sexism the campaign has long fired at the media boomeranged when CNN's Campbell Brown accused the campaign of keeping Palin chauvinistically under wraps.
End this chauvinistic treatment of her now. Let her have a real news conference with real questions. By treating Sarah Palin different from the other candidates in this race, you're not showing her the respect she deserves. Free Sarah Palin.
The bad media news for Barack Obama was that McCain and Palin, along with the financial crisis, dominated the headlines. The good media news for Barack Obama was that McCain and Palin, along with the financial crisis, dominated the headlines.
The market is not functioning properly. There has been a widespread loss of confidence, and major sectors of America's financial system are at risk of shutting down.
The Bush administration's bailout plan calls for Congress to hand over $700 billion to be spent as Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson sees fit. No strings, no oversight, no peeking, not even by the courts. It's like if you looked up carte blanche in the dictionary, you'd see a little picture of Paulson. In an open letter to colleagues on Tuesday, former New York Times financial reporter David K. Johnston urged fellow journalists to be, above all, skeptical. Quote, "As of now, we are as a group behaving just as we did the last two times the administration sought to rush through a hastily thought out, ill-conceived plan. Why in the world are we being so gullible and naive? What happened to the core value of journalism? Check it out." David, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Brooke.
So that was quite a cri de coeur, which apparently was prompted by this bit of seemingly innocuous boilerplate voiced by NBC's Tom Brokaw on Meet the Press last Sunday.
Can a government rescue plan save our economy? And at what cost to U.S. taxpayers?
Brokaw and many other journalists on TV and some in print and on the radio assumed, because we were told there's a crisis, there's a crisis. Now, the fact that we've had a couple of big firms on Wall Street fail, that's capitalism. If you look around, you'll notice that banks are still making ordinary loans to ordinary businesses. Your mailbox is still full of proposals to sell you credit cards and extend you debt. The internet still has ads for these very toxic mortgages that are at the heart of this. They're being advertised all over the internet. You know, I don't have any doubt that whatever people in the market have said to Secretary Paulson has scared him. But remember that Secretary Paulson used to be the head of Goldman Sachs, the biggest investment bank in the country. And Goldman Sachs has announced that it's converting itself into an investment bank, which will allow it, by the way, to get in on this $700 billion. That alone ought to have people asking questions, well, wait a minute, what's the pricing of this deal and who's going to make money off it?
But you've also seen the markets going, you know, down 500, up 300. I mean, if that's not an indication of crisis, what is?
Well, we've had many other occasions in the past where the markets have behaved like this.
Like this?
Yes, where markets have wild swings from day to day because of something going on around us. Likewise, much has been made of a technical issue called the TED spread. It's the difference between the interest rate on short-term euros and short-term treasuries. And the TED spread is quite large right now. But if you look back many years, it's been this large on other occasions. So it's an indicator there may be a big problem, but it's not definitive proof of that. And my point is not to argue that there is or is not a crisis, but that journalists need to begin not by questioning around the edges, but by going to the core question. Is this the least expensive way to do this? Are there market solutions that might be applied? Here's a simple one. No one I've seen has asked the Treasury, did you ask every bank to submit to you data on how many illiquid assets you have, what you bought them at, and what you value them at now? That might identify the problem is concentrated in a handful of banks. Let's have disclosure. Would that perhaps cause a couple of banks to suddenly go out of business? Yeah, might well do that. But if it's a cheaper solution, maybe that's a better idea.
But David, it's urgent. There's no time for that kind of fol-de-rol.
That's politics. That's not economics. Congress had set September 26th as the date when they would go into recess so members could go home and campaign. If this is such a gigantic crisis that we have to put out $700 billion, which we may never get back, then perhaps Congress needs to stay in session. And by the way, if members of Congress do have to go home because they've got tough races, we have this modern thing called a jet airplane. They can run home for a day, make a vote, and go back to the campaign trail.
Those are cool. I've seen those. So when you lowered the boom on Romanesco, a website that all of us regularly read, so you knew it would get around,
you were hoping that maybe you could have some direct impact on the coverage across the rest of the week. Did you find that those questions were being asked?
I did. You know, I'm known as a bit of a crank for posting these sort of let's stick to the basics questions in journalism at the Romanesco site. And last night in my hotel down here in Texas, I was watching, I frankly don't remember which of the cable channels, but somebody asked the question, well, are there alternatives? Now, the answer they got wasn't a very good answer, but they at least asked the question, are there alternatives? I'll tell you one thing that disheartened me, and that was the number of reports that immediately jumped on. The FBI is investigating criminal wrongdoing. This is fundamentally not a story of criminal wrongdoing. This is a story of the structure of government and the rules that define our society. Yes, there are crooks. There are always crooks. It's the policy that's the big story, not the crooks. That's the cheap story. It's an important story, but it's the cheap story. The big one is how the government acted.
In the search for wrongdoers, prominent among them in the media are the short sellers. These seem to be the principal villains maligned in press accounts. Can you explain who they are and whether they've gotten a bad rap?
When you buy a stock, you're doing what's called going long, and you're betting the stock price will rise. Well, there are people who instead sell stock they don't own. They borrow it and they sell it, hoping to buy back at a cheaper price and profit from the price falling. I mean, there are plenty of offenses committed by short sellers, as there are by people on the other side, the longs. But it's easy to demonize the short sellers because most people don't think in terms of what they do. Short sellers provide a valuable service by deflating artificially high stock prices. Now, the Treasury Department, which in this administration has said free markets are virtually a god, free markets are not to be interfered with, has now interfered in the market. It has put its thumb on the scale by prohibiting trading in about 900 companies by the shorts. It is biasing the market upwards. That's not free market capitalism. That is state-directed markets and corporate socialism. That's something we ought to be asking tough questions about.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
David K. Johnston is a former investigative reporter for the New York Times and author, most recently, of Free Lunch.
Coming up, a short-selling whistleblower and Amy Goodman bound but not gagged at the Republican National Convention.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As you just heard, a short seller is an investor who makes money when stock prices go down. And they've been vilified as vultures during the current implosion on Wall Street. David Einhorn, a manager of a multi-billion dollar hedge fund, is one such short seller. But he also turns out to be a truth teller. 6 years ago, Einhorn stumbled on a well-reviewed company named Allied Capital that he thought wasn't coming clean about its financial health. So he decided to offer his perspective at an investors conference. As Hugo Lindgren wrote in June's New York Magazine, what Einhorn thought would be a merely interesting speech changed his life.
He gave a fairly rigorous presentation of what he perceived as the company's problems, and that was sort of what he expected to be the end of it.
As someone who sometimes sells short, who bets on the company's fortunes to go down, he was immediately suspect for having a stake in this. If he says something nasty about Allied Capital, Allied Capital's stock price goes down, he profits, no?
Oh, yeah, he does. The stock did go down immediately thereafter. I think it went down about 10%, in large part because his opinion so conflicted with the kind of Wall Street conventional wisdom on the stock. Allied Capital was a very popular pick among a lot of Wall Street analysts, and it also paid a pretty healthy dividend, which a lot of investors liked. So it was a pretty radical move on his part.
And he was treated radically.
Well, a whole lot of things happened, and it took several years for it all to transpire, in part because he just refused to back down from his original position, as perhaps a lot of people would have. A lot of it was just, at first, just an awful lot of name-calling. But the larger case was that they really started to try to mount an investigation into him. He was threatened with all kinds of things from the company, and then and eventually an agent of the company searched his phone records. If he'd said something positive about Allied Capital, no one really would have cared. But because he dared to sort of have a negative opinion about it, suddenly that was seen as instantly suspect, although his profit motive in either case could have been the same. Many of the other presenters at that conference and all over television and in the whole rest of the world often tout stocks that they own. But touting the shorting of a stock was perceived as being fundamentally different.
Was he right about Allied?
Yeah, he was right about Allied, and the company has been struggling to catch up to his critique for most of the last 6 years.
Now, there's something just so paradoxical about all of this, because whistleblowers tend to get attention because they are telling the truth while putting their own careers at risk. But a hedge fund manager who's shorting stocks and who is similarly being a whistleblower is immediately suspect. But his answer was, okay, don't believe me. Obviously, I have a vested interest in this stock going down. But go look at this company. Look at its balance sheet. Look at its income statements. He's telling the financial press, just do your due diligence and the issue will no longer be me. Did the press take him up on that?
Although there were people who understood David Einhorn's track record and respected his sort of analytical skills, there were some who supported him in the financial media. The whole complexity of accounting in not just in Allied Capital, but in financial companies are so complex that I think the financial media, for the most part, doesn't do a lot of independent evaluation of companies. They trust what the analysts say. They trust what, for the most part, what the companies say until recently. And so, no, I think for the most part, the financial media did not do its due diligence.
Okay, so flash forward 6 years, Einhorn, in spite of having endured what he endured in the Allied Capital episode, makes a similar public pronouncement about Lehman Brothers, which he said was in a precarious financial position. What happened this time around?
Well, largely the same thing. I mean, financial companies, mostly Lehman Brothers, fought back and tried to battle against the short sellers. But to his benefit, all the things that he said were problematic with the company were quickly becoming apparent. He was, in large part, quickly vindicated because his whole argument from the very beginning was what Lehman Brothers needed to do was come clean with investors and to show what the problems on their books really were.
So what is the moral of the David Einhorn story? When a whistleblower has a vested interest, you know, do you pay attention to what he's saying or do you pay attention to what he stands to gain? What is a financial reporter to do?
Well, I think the important thing is to try to get away from the personalities a little bit and look at what they're actually talking about. And that's something that David Einhorn was very explicit about saying is like, if the story becomes about David Einhorn, then he is already losing. What he wants the story to be about is like, well, here is what I see as their problems. What do you think? Do you believe what they say? Who has the better command of the facts? Who is laying out a more convincing picture? There's all kinds of financial chicanery going on. There's all kinds of manipulation of the market every day. But as someone who's going to be investing in the market and tries to figure out what's happening by reading the media, you have to evaluate for yourself what you believe to be true.
Hugo, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hugo Lindgren is a writer and editor for New York Magazine. Collapse, crisis, failure, all words the president used in his primetime address on the economy this week. For business reporters, though, such words pose a different challenge. They're supposed to avoid influencing events with their language. But when does too much caution in choosing words become incautious? Andy Serwer is the managing editor of Fortune magazine. He says that sometimes you just have to call a panic a panic.
You have to really be careful about yelling fire in a crowded theater, obviously. On the other hand, is it really your job to say, don't worry, don't panic, sit tight? I'm not sure if that's anyone's job in the press to do that. And last week, there was a panic in the financial markets. There's no question. When the price of gold soared a record one-day jump, I mean, if that's not a panic, I don't know what is.
Now, you raised the subject of the crowded theater. I noticed that for all the coverage of the Wall Street debacle, nobody actually has come out with a blaring headline that says, run for your life. Do you suppose that's because business media don't wish to make the panic worse?
I don't think that you shouldn't say it's a panic if you really think it is. I believe, and while it sounds trite to say this, it really is true, you've got to ride this out to a great extent. I mean, we're not saying that you shouldn't look at your investment portfolio and your 401k and make sure that, you know, you don't own things that are toxic. But selling everything and running off and putting your money in the mattress, it's probably not going to make any sense at all to do that.
We began this conversation talking about the special responsibility that financialist journalists have in understanding that what they print or say on the air could move markets up or down. But what about the responsibility for due diligence? It seems to me that over the last few years, there were plenty of opportunities for magazines like Fortune to really dig into the balance sheet and the accounting practices of companies like Lehman Brothers. But clearly, media outlets did not unearth how serious the problems were in advance. You know, how plead you?
Guilty to an extent. I think all of us in the financial press are. Having said that, if you go back and you look at our magazine and the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, we've all done stories that say this company or that company or this financial product is a ticking time bomb. The problem with those stories is that unless the bomb goes off, people forget about them and say, oh, that's not true. You know, we wrote a story, for instance, going all the way back to 1994, saying that derivatives were this hidden time bomb that had the potential to undermine our entire financial system. Gee, did it really take 14 years to happen? Well, yeah, it did. There are stories like that. I think that we're guilty of not doing enough of them, but I think also people are guilty maybe of not paying enough attention a little bit.
But what about the celebratory nature of so much financial journalism, including Fortune? You did a fairly glowing profile just a couple years back of Richard Fuld, the CEO of Lehman Brothers. We often see these executives portrayed as kind of masters of the universe when in fact they're leading us on a path to hell.
Well, you know, I'll have to plead guilty as charged there a little bit. In that particular story about Dick Fuld, we said that he has managed to capitalize on this one particular type of business, but will he take it too far? You know, we did show that there was the potential for a problem there. I don't mean to be, waffly on this, but we have some pretty sophisticated people who do darn good work, but sometimes, through the lens of history, it doesn't hold up.
Let me ask you one final thing.
Mm-hmm.
It has become clear in this crisis that some of these investment banking houses were, as it's been described, lying to their own computers and in the valuation of some of these derivatives and other securities, actually misrepresenting internally in a way that clearly obscured the trouble. Fortune employed some of the most sophisticated financial journalists in the world. And yet, are they up to the task of understanding the complexity of some of these securities and for evaluating them?
I think we've got people here who do understand derivatives, credit default swaps, as well as anyone on Wall Street. Now, having said that, the best minds on Wall Street got it wrong. You're right in saying that this is the ultimate in financial complexity. And it's very hard to report. It's very hard to make it palatable. There were a certain set of circumstances that occurred that were just right that created a perfect storm. The mortgage meltdown, easy credit, derivatives that people didn't understand.
Predatory lending practices.
Predatory lending practices.
Conflict of interest in loan origination.
No regulation, inappropriate regulation. And it all came together, and it sort of reminds me of the Beatles song, The Day in the Life. Do you know when the music kind of comes up in a crescendo at the end?
Yeah.
That's what last week reminded me of. And unfortunately, that ringing tone is still going on.
Andy, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Andy Serwer is managing editor of Fortune magazine.
of us who watched the Republican National Convention at home earlier this month believe we saw it. We saw the calls for public service and patriotism, the passionate endorsements of McCain's former opponents, the triumphant unveiling of the vice presidential nominee. We probably didn't see what was going on outside the convention in the streets of St. Paul, but that too was an important story. Thousands of protesters, a few intent on violence, but most gathered peacefully, swept up and corralled some 800 arrested, including reporters, mostly of the alternative media, charged simply for being on the scene. Other groups, notably the Eyewitness Video Collective, famous for the evidence it gathered of police misconduct during the RNC in New York 4 years ago, were preemptively detained for a few hours at their residence. Amy Goodman, host of the radio and TV program Democracy Now!, and two of her producers were among those reporters arrested on the street. After much public protest, the charges against them were dropped. St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman said, quote, "This decision reflects the values we have in St. Paul to protect and promote our First Amendment rights to freedom of the press." But Goodman says she saw little sign of those values when word reached her inside the convention hall that two of her crew had been arrested, one of them bloodied by police.
So I race from the convention floor, you know, my credentials are dangling from my neck with our cameraman, and we're racing to 7th and Jackson in St. Paul. And as I get there, the riot police are all lined up. It's a fully contained area at this point. So I just come up to them and I immediately say, I'm a credentialed journalist, and can I speak to your commanding officer? Two of our producers who are also credentialed are inside and I want them released. And I mean, within seconds, they'd rip me through the line. They were twisting my arms behind my back. They slapped those rigid plastic handcuffs on that dig into your wrists. They put me up against the wall and they pushed me on the ground. And I was continuing to say, you can see I'm a credentialed reporter. I need to see my producers, because I had heard they were hurt. I mean, I've got the highest security credentials. I can be next to presidents, vice presidents, on the convention floor, senators, congress members. Whereupon the Secret Service came over and ripped the credentials from around my neck.
The city attorney said that just because charges aren't pursued doesn't mean that the arrest was improper. And he went on to say it's an officer's responsibility to protect public safety and control a scene. Prosecutors decide whether charges are warranted. Do you have a problem with that general proposition?
All I can say is it was very clear who we were. This had nothing to do with security. And, I mean, the arrest of Nicole Salazar, one of our producers, you know, the police came at her, the riot police, very quickly. She's in a parking lot, so she's trapped by the parked cars. She's holding up her credential with one hand, and she's holding her camera with the other. They're shouting, face on the ground, face on the ground. And she's saying, press, press.
Get down on your face! On your face!
Get down on your face!
Get down on your face!
They've got their knee or boot in her back. Another is pulling on her leg, but her face is in the ground. They bloody her face. And what's one of the first things they do? They pull the battery out of her camera.
So why do you think it got that ugly?
I think that's a good question to put to the police. It's the question I put to the police on the morning after our arrests. What are you telling your police officers to do? How are you expecting that we will operate? I mean, we are talking about a situation where with the arrests, the beating, the pepper spraying of journalists, you had a lot of journalists who were not going to go out there. I mean, let's face it. Let's say your editor wants you to cover what's going on in the convention and you want to go outside because you see there are thousands of people that are out there. And maybe you could do that and then run in and do the job that they asked you to do. And maybe you could even get some of that into your story. You're not going to risk it if you could be arrested if you go outside and then you're not there to do what your editor wanted you to do. It has a chilling effect. It prevents journalists from doing their job, but it also really hurts the public. Reporters have to be able to put things on the record without getting a record.
So what do you think of the mainstream media's coverage of this protest and of street protests in general?
Well, after the arrest, I went into the convention center because I was being interviewed by different media. And I was standing next to an NBC reporter who was doing some of his stand-ups. And he was listening to my description. He came over and said, "I don't understand. How come I wasn't arrested if you've been arrested?" So I said, "Oh, were you covering the protests?" And he said, "Well, no." And I said, "Well, it's sort of like Woody Allen's line, 90% of life is just showing up. I wasn't being arrested in the skyboxes either or the convention floor."
On the other hand,
Is every march, is every protest a story that needs a full media complement? These are, in effect, designed to attract media attention. Do the media have to take the bait?
I think it's our job to cover all of it. I mean, let's talk about who was out in the streets. It was anti-war voices, those who were opposed to torture. And I would say that those who are opposed to war and torture are not a fringe minority or not a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the corporate media.
A lot of people think that there's an active conspiracy afoot to close those voices out, that there are literally meetings with journalists and publishers in which they are instructed not to include those voices. I have never heard of any such meetings.
You know, it's interesting. When we were out covering the protests in the streets of Seattle in 1999, the Battle of Seattle, one of the local networks put out a memo to the people who work there that they were not to cover people who engaged in civil disobedience. If that philosophy were used 40, 45 years ago, we wouldn't even know Dr. Martin Luther King's name. It's not so much telling you you can't do this. It's a kind of self-censorship that goes on. It's much more a mindset. It's the worlds people come out of, and it's the worlds they're trying to protect and the worlds they think are not important.
Given what went on in St. Paul, given what's gone on at previous conventions, are there some preemptive acts that you can take in order to cover the next ones?
Well, wear a gas mask.
Amy, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Brooke.
Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman is the co-author with David Goodman of Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times.
Up next, free speech can cost you your tax exemption. Should clergy be allowed to endorse candidates from the pulpit?
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And the Wallace Foundation, whose knowledge center is where education leaders can go to learn about improving teaching and learning. Downloads at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with some updates from the Secrecy Files, actually from the excellent Secrecy News blog by Stephen Aftergood. For the first time in a long time, we're seeing some sunshine. 2 weeks ago, we reported on a lawsuit filed by the group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, against Vice President Dick Cheney, among others. CREW's complaint was that Cheney was unresponsive to the legal requirement that he turn over his documents, all of them, to the National Archives at the end of the term. Cheney maintained that a big chunk of those papers, those generated by activities outside the executive branch, were exempt. That would include documents related to his work in the Senate or for other agencies. For example, records of his efforts to win reauthorization of the warrantless wiretapping program for the National Security Agency would be his to keep or shred. That sparked grave concern among CREW and the historians who were party to that suit.
We're not talking about records that we think eventually will become available for public review.
CREW's chief counsel, Anne Weissman.
We're talking about records that, unless they're covered by this act, may be destroyed altogether. And I think it's an especially acute loss when you consider how enormously active this vice president has been, probably more than any other vice president in history.
Last Saturday, CREW won the first round. U.S. District Court Judge Colleen Kohler-Catelli issued a preliminary injunction ordering the vice president and the National Archives to preserve all his official records.
And it's been a good month for the ACLU. On September 22nd, a federal court ordered the Defense Department to release 21 photographs depicting the abuse of detainees by U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. This is the end of a long court battle that began with the Freedom of Information Act request in 2003. We spoke to Emily Whitfield, who was the ACLU's spokesperson in 2005, about the power of pictures.
The Abu Ghraib photos really galvanized the public around this issue, and it made them understand in a way that no amount of paper documents ever would what exactly was going on over there. We know these photos exist. The Army certainly knows it, and they are desperate not to have them released. I can tell you how desperate the Army recently argued to the court in trying to resist releasing these photos, that to release photos of prisoners and videotapes of prisoners would violate the prisoners' Geneva Convention rights, which it's just so ironic. It's hard to believe.
On September 22nd, the court agreed, noting that the conventions were intended to prevent the abuse of prisoners, not to obstruct those who, quote, seek information about prisoner abuse in an effort to help deter it. The government also argued that the photos were exempt under FOIA because they could be used to incite violence and endanger the lives of individuals. But the court said the FOIA exemption could not be used as an, quote, all-purpose damper on global controversy. ACLU staff attorney Armit Singh called the decision a resounding victory for the public's right to hold the government accountable.
Which brings us to this week's third and final piece of secrecy news. Earlier this month, a bill introduced in the Senate by Democrats Russ Feingold and Dianne Feinstein responds to the Bush administration's use of secret opinions from the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, or OLC. The new bill would require that the Attorney General report to Congress whenever the Department of Justice issues a secret legal opinion indicating that the executive branch is not bound by existing law. The Act notes that the current White House has relied heavily on OLC opinions in matters ranging from warrantless wiretapping to torture to the detention of U.S. citizens. Under this bill, the Office of Legal Counsel would have to notify Congress whenever it issued an opinion advising the White House that it is, in any given matter, above the law. This is probably just a political gesture. Its chances of passage are nil. Maybe it's just a primal scream. But sometimes it's nice just to hear the screaming.
Undecided voters can go lots of places for advice on who to vote for. Church is not one of those places. Clergy may sermonize about political issues, but they may not advocate for a particular candidate, because a 1954 tax code provision known as the Johnson Amendment prohibits nonprofit organizations from, quote, intervening in elections. But does that fly in the face of freedom of speech and religion? A group called the Alliance Defense Fund thinks so, and is organizing pastors to force the issue September 28th by intentionally violating the no endorsement rules in their sermons. Eric Stanley is an attorney with the ADF, which calls the protest Pulpit Freedom Sunday.
They are pastors that are scattered across the country. They will preach a sermon on Sunday. That sermon will evaluate the current candidates for office in light of Scripture, and we'll make specific recommendations based on that evaluation. And if the IRS chooses to investigate and come after these churches, then we will file suit against the IRS on behalf of these churches and seek to have the Johnson Amendment overturned as unconstitutional.
So you're saying, make us test cases, bring it on.
Yes, in essence, that's what we're saying. And, you know, these pastors firmly believe that they should have the right to speak freely from the pulpit, that what they are doing is not political speech, that this is core religious expression, that it is applying the Bible, applying Scripture to every area of life, including candidates and elections, and they shouldn't be censored or punished for that.
But what part of vote for John McCain or vote for Barack Obama has anything to do with biblical truth? Where's the Scripture behind that?
What they will do is they will address the current candidates for office in light of what the scriptural teachings on the issues are and how the candidates stack up against those biblical teachings on the issues.
Now, a U.S. district court has ruled on this issue in the past, and the ruling was that churches are not prohibited from any kind of exercise of free speech, but that in exchange for what the Supreme Court has called a subsidy, that is to say their tax-exempt status, they simply have to refrain from explicit endorsements from the pulpit.
The case that you're talking about is the Church of Pierce Creek case, Branch Ministries, which was a newspaper ad that was run by a church. The church conceded that it was not part of their free exercise of religion to run that newspaper ad. Here we're talking about a completely different set of facts, a pastor preaching to his congregation from the pulpit on a Sunday morning. You can't get any more of the core free exercise of religion than that.
Now, this principle obviously is very important to you because, as I understand it, by encouraging these 33 pastors to flout the IRS regulations, that you could lose your ability to practice before the tax bar, that you could be disqualified from arguing in cases with the IRS. Is that true?
I can't obviously stop them from trying, but I think that we are not encouraging a violation of the federal tax law here. What we're doing is engaging in activities that other groups, like the ACLU even, engage in on a daily basis. If one of our citizens is confronted with a law that infringes on their constitutional rights to free speech or free exercise of religion, whatever it may be, then that individual has the option to freely exercise their constitutional rights. If the government chooses to enforce the law against them, then they have a right to cease their activities, go to federal court, and ask the court to decide the constitutionality of that law. That's what these pastors are doing. They're freely exercising their constitutional rights.
Civil disobedience, in other words.
Well, you know, and I wouldn't even characterize it as civil disobedience. What I would characterize it as is obedience to the Constitution. It was an unconstitutional piece of legislation when it was passed, and it's unconstitutional now.
Now, the American Civil Liberties Union and more than 100 other pastors are lined up against you on this. They preached last Sunday, not with a political endorsement, but rather arguing against your pulpit initiative. They believe that what's at issue here is the separation of church and state. Why are they wrong?
Well, it's interesting that they will argue very forcefully for the separation of church and state, but in this instance, what they're actually asking for by continuing the Johnson Amendment is continued government control and censorship over the pulpit, continued entanglement of the government with religion, in essence. What we're doing here is trying to enforce a very healthy separation between church and state, to really get the government out of the pulpits of America once and for all, because the government and government agents have no business parsing the words of a sermon to determine whether the law is violated or not. This, at base, is a theological discussion that churches and pastors need to debate among themselves. This is not a theological debate that the government should come down on one side or the other on.
All right. Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Eric Stanley is senior counsel with the Alliance Defense Fund. The Reverend Eric Williams is sending a very different message to his flock at the North Congregational United Church of Christ in Columbus, Ohio. Last Sunday, he urged clergy across the nation to preach from the pulpit against repealing the Johnson Amendment and for the IRS to take action against the ADF. He may have led the charge, but he says many heard the call.
It's been a charge that's been very easy to lead because the vast majority of clergy, I think, around the nation understand what's at stake. They understand that the separation of church and state largely protects the religious freedoms we enjoy.
All right, that's understood, but my understanding of the separation of church and state is that it's supposed to keep the state out of the business of the church and not vice versa.
Well, it's a separation that seeks both parties to honor the unique role the other party plays. And I really look at this initiative by the Alliance Defense Fund as an attempt to entangle the church with government. They portray it as just the opposite, but in fact, if a religious leader is so concerned about endorsing a candidate, then they really have their eye towards the political process rather than the role that the church usually plays in the public discussion.
But what about the free speech issue here? Why should a church be penalized by losing its tax exemption for expressing a view on anything, political or otherwise?
Well, the tax exemption really is a privilege. It's not a right. Really, any minister can endorse a candidate. You just can't do that using tax dollars. So if the minister is willing to set aside that tax-exempt status, that's fine. Or why can't the minister just step out of the pulpit, take off the robe, cross the street to be off of church property and endorse as a private citizen. It's not really, in my mind, a question of free speech. It's really a question of abusing the privileged role that charities, in this case churches, have, the government extend to them, to use tax dollars to endorse candidates.
Some people, including the Supreme Court of the United States, have described the tax exemption as a subsidy for churches to do their charitable and spiritual work.
Uh-huh.
But the people on the other side of this argument at the Alliance Defense Fund object to the word subsidy. They think that skews the discussion. Is that the right word?
Well, I don't think it would be a word that I would choose, but I certainly understand and would agree with that choice. We need to look at church history, and we need to look at our own national history. When those first immigrants came over, they were coming over for several reasons, but central was religious freedom. I would describe our nation as a religious nation. You know, a lot of the values, religious values that we hold individually inform, I think, the polity and practice of our government. And so the government has recognized that among all the charities, the church, the synagogue, the mosque is something that does good work. There is this historic understanding between the government and the religious community that elevates the status of the religious community so that it can do the good work. And I like the word elevated because I think that is our role. We need to be above politics. We should not ever seek to entangle ourselves with politics.
The Republic seemed to, you know, blunder along pretty well for 180 years before the 1954 statute that removes tax exemptions for explicitly political nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
What changed 54 years ago that made the government have to use the tax code as both a carrot and a stick?
I can't be honest and say I know in detail all that went into that 1954 amendment. My understanding, it was clearly a logical, reasonable expression of this evolution of our democratic process. When the Pilgrims and Puritans came over, there were only three or four different denominations. Today we have over 300 world religions, and I think that the separation of church and state is one of those safeguards that allows each of those 300 religions to worship and to conduct their life in a way, again, that's free from the kind of government control or influence that the original immigrants fled to this nation to enjoy.
I have to invoke the Reverend Martin Luther King here,
sure.
Who himself used the pulpit as a bully pulpit, not only to advance the cause of civil rights, but to condemn the war in Vietnam and implicitly the Johnson administration. Do you think he was abusing the privileges of his pulpit?
He was in no way endorsing or opposing a candidate running for office. He was doing the good, hard, prophetic work that I think churches should be doing. If he had become entangled in the election process, he would have lost the integrity, he would have lost the moral authority that he could bring to opposing the war and opposing some of those issues of the government. So Martin Luther King understood that he could approach that line of separation, but dare not cross it. He could very reasonably, prophetically, passionately, and legally push all the social issues of the day without violating the law. That was the genius he brought, I think, to the movement he led.
Well, Reverend Williams, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Bob. Take care.
Eric Williams is senior pastor at the North Congregational United Church of Christ in Columbus, Ohio.
Seen promising young black boys who are already facing discrimination at home, going away and dying in disproportionate numbers in Vietnam. We are 11% of the population here, and we are 22 4/10% of the dying force in Vietnam. These are facts that we must hear. Somebody tells me that these two issues can't be mixed. They are mixed. I didn't mix them. The war mixed them. Our nation spends approximately $500,000 to kill every enemy soldier. And we spend about $53 a year on every person categorized as poverty-stricken, and half of this goes for the salaries of those who are not poor. Now, there are some tragic priorities here. This war has hurt the humility of our nation. We've come to believe somehow that we are God's appointed agent to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. We're arrogant in feeling that we have everything to teach other nations and nothing to learn from them. We're arrogant in not allowing young nations to go through the same turbulence and revolution that characterized our own history. We're arrogant in talking about we are concerned about the liberties of others overseas and refuse to set our own house in order.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We had production help from Michael Bernstein. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the School of Visual Arts, hosting an open house for the graduate-level program Master of Fine Arts Design Criticism on October 25th at the New York campus. More at designcriticism.sva.edu. Support for On the Media also comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.